Okay, I'll guess.
Okay, please guess.
Hey, stupid Jeff. The guess is that it's colorized for a particular spectrum.
Okay. Now, would you like to hazard a guess why it needs to be colorized for a particular spectrum?
No, I'm done sounding stupid on that for tonight. Thanks. ACTPL.
No one sounds stupid. We're all trying to learn things. The good point to some of the Hubble telescope is that it was kind of a full visual spectral telescope. It did a little bit of infrared, it did a little bit of ultraviolet, and it did a good portion of visible. Unfortunately, or fortunately, the James Webb Space Telescope is designed differently. The purpose when they started to design the James Webb Space Telescope was that they really wanted to look at far away, very, 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 very old galaxies. And the problem with that is, as you go farther and farther away from here, you go back in time, and you also get a phase shift. You get a Doppler shift. So what used to be visible became infrared. So all the galaxies that are as far away as things like the Cartwheel galaxy are not really visible anymore in the visible spectrum. All of that image that we're seeing in those pictures are gussied up infrared signals. The James Webb Space Telescope is optimized primarily for the near-infrared. It does a little bit of red and orange, but you know, no green or blue. And so what generally happens is if you take an actual image and you look at it in the visible spectrum, it looks like next to nothing. So they basically false colorize it based upon the infrared spectrum analysis and some educated guesses of the aesthetics of how they think it should look if you were closer up and you didn't give it enough time to Doppler shift into the invisible infrared. So the original is completely infrared for the most part. These are all gussied up with computer optimizations.
Hey, it's a Dale Query.
Yes, Jeff.
What would that say in that case about the local galactic event kind of within one whatever parsec of that centroid of the Cartwheel?
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Also, I want to add that by using the near-infrared, you get around the problem that a lot of these things there's a lot of dust between us and them. And in the infrared spectrum, a lot of that dust is made almost invisible. But can you rephrase the question, Jeff?
Hey, it's Bill, naturally. So there's quite a spectrum of coloration in the kind of edited, obviously clarified image. So with a very powerful, strong ring around the Cartwheel, and then some kind of strong spokes, and then different colored spokes. So what does it say about what's actually happening there, the different colors that are within the kind of the central part of that image?
I believe the interpretation that is generally told to us guys who don't have PhDs in the field, that you can somewhat discern the places where stars are being born. The bluish colorations are supposedly new stars in their cradle coming into existence. The more orangey portions are fully formed star clusters. And they've come up with interesting theories. They believe that these are all kind of, they're looking at things called what do they call them again? They call them rimmed. I think they call, ringed galaxies. There's pinwheel galaxies are ringed, and there's these cartwheel galaxies. And the understanding that they're kind of presenting to people is that what this is the result of a regular spiral galaxy that collided at a specific angle with another galaxy right in the middle. And that's what kind of smashed everything up. And they say that, you know, in a couple of hundred million years, the ring will slowly kind of dissolve into the spikes, and it will regain its spiral configuration ultimately.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially when you think of the fact that redshift and blueshift has directionality. I mean, this is not an isotropic event.
Well, yeah, that's true, too. I don't know if their algorithms use the differing Doppler shifts. I assume they do. That's probably part of the algorithm. They're just kind of upsizing it or upcoding it to visual spectrum. Some of it might be that some objects are going away from us and other objects are going towards us. And so within the overall Doppler shift towards the infrared, there are some that are kind of racing towards us that slightly Doppler shifts it to a slightly higher frequency. So, yeah. There's probably some of that as well. I'd be real curious with a bigger discussion on how they kind of came up with the total algorithms for the fake color. Because eventually there's going to be some idiot who thinks the world is flat that thinks that they're just painting a pretty picture. So I don't know if it translates well into people who don't know much about astronomy, but I would be fascinated. I'll be looking at the YouTubes and such to see if anything like that's available.
That's a great question with a lot of different layers to it. Thank you very much, Rory.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I had fun with it, and when we are done, if you want to go back to the link, you know, after the TechNet, I have another image of the same exact pose of the cartwheel galaxy, but this time it's done by the Hubble. And aside from the fact that, you know, some people will say, well, it's easy to tell the difference between the Hubble and the James Webb. The Hubble is kind of washed out. It's lower resolution. Again, because it just has a smaller aperture, so the sensors probably have a lower dynamic range. But you could mess up the James Webb image but still retain that eight-spoked star, and you still kind of know that it's from the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's there. Anyway, any other comments with anyone on the subject of the James Webb Space Telescope? It's a fascinating device. I look forward to hearing all kinds of amazing stuff that it finds out there in the outer reaches of our observable universe. We've mentioned before that the nature of an expanding universe is that some portion of our universe will never be able to be perceived because it's too far away that even light will never reach us from it. And so we don't know the boundaries of the universe. We only know or can calculate the boundary of the observable universe. Given 13.8 billion years of time for light to reach us. So astronomy is a fascinating subject, and, Dick, may he rest in peace, used to talk a lot about the James Webb Space Telescope, and I'm sad that he wasn't around to see it in its glory. Once again, this is AC2GS. Anyone with any other comments about the James Webb Space Telescope before I guess I'll ask if anyone has any other questions for tonight? Okay, I guess we're talked out on the James Webb Space Telescope. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net. We're still open for any questions if you want. Unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, Paul is under the weather, so he won't be doing the SpaceNet report. So, you know, when we run out of questions or anything for me to do, we'll call it a night. So how long the TechNet persists tonight is all on you guys. You got any questions or comments, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
As I mentioned to you during the week, I think that NASA has a big public relations problem on their hands in terms of the pictures coming from the Webb telescope, in that we've all seen beautiful, awe-inspiring pictures from space. These look no different, you know, to 99.9% of the public. So the billions that it costs might be a problem with some people in the population, because other than being a scientist, a space scientist, the pictures look no different. They have to A&D them all the time. They always publish the before and after pictures. If you notice, that's what NASA's doing. But this thing costs a lot of money. I'm all for it, and I'm not against it. I just think NASA is going to have a pretty hard time unless they make some incredible, gargantuan discovery that was totally unexpected, you know, dark matter or black hole-wise or whatever. I wonder if you agree, Roy. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's always a problem of government-sponsored research programs. You have to keep the populace entertained. It's the point of the exercise is not to provide the average guy with pretty pictures that he can perhaps put on his wall, although they'll probably will be selling reprints of this in a matter of days. It's the extension of our understanding of the universe and all that portends. You know, with accelerators, with CERN and such. If you take a picture of the accelerator complex, it looks about the same. It's not very exciting. The imaging of the accelerated particles that collide with each other and spiral and decay away is kind of vaguely, curiously interesting to some, but for the most part, no one has the faintest idea other than the scientists what the heck it means. So, I mean, there's not even pretty pictures with CERN, and CERN costs a pretty penny. Again, it's not designed to amuse us. It's designed to understand, instead of the universe, the hyper-micro-microscopic subatomic level. So I understand and I agree with you, and as a public relations kind of brain turned on, yeah, it's going to be a bit of a problem. And plus, let me drop for a second. I have an amusing story just that kind of highlights that. A couple of days ago, some guy released, I think it was in French, one of those Instagram things where he had this circular object that was kind of variegated, and in French he said that this was some astronomical object that was photographed by the James Webb Telescope. The only problem is that I think a couple hours later, someone figured out that was just an image of a piece of sausage that was cut and sliced thin and just put in a black background. So there's already people kind of pulling that nonsense with James Webb images.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
Yeah, this is about the James Webb telescope. The fact that the mirrors on that telescope are so exposed, I know the Hubble, the mirror was inside that tube, so it was kind of shielded from a lot of micrometeor activity, but the James Webb telescope, all those mirrors are exposed. Isn't that going to put a sort of a finite lifetime on that when enough micrometeor activity messes up the reflecting surface of those mirrors?
Well, I think the understanding is it's not a kind of off and on. It's a gradual degradation of the beautiful optical quality of the mirror. And again, it was my understanding that when they designed it and made it so kind of open-ended, they kind of over-engineered the optics. The optical tolerances of the mirror segments are much more precise than the sensors that capture the image. So the idea of the engineers was that when it was launched, it would just be overkill. Optically, the quality would not be able to reach the sensor and be transmitted. So that over time, as the mirrors degraded, there'd be a point where eventually the over-engineering would no longer exist, and you'd kind of reach the point where any future dents will impact on the image. I think they were surprised recently by the micrometeorite that put a dent in one of the segments. So I don't know if that thought way back when they were designing it was quite as brilliant as they thought it was at the time. But I think that's the idea, that they over-engineered the mirrors so that the degradation wouldn't be that severe until a certain number of years anyway. And the problem is, along with other things, the James Webb is not really designed to be repaired. It's in L2. As opposed to the Hubble that was reachable by the shuttles and such. So, it's out there for its duration, and we'll see how the micrometeorites, what they do to them.
And that's another point, too. Those vibration points, don't they tend to collect a lot of stuff? I mean, because of the fact that they are stability points, doesn't stuff tend to collect there, like micrometeors? I know L4 and L5 have a lot of junk in them. I think they even the Earth even had another larger object at the leading one, L4. So I thought these libration points tend to collect stuff.
Yeah, I agree entirely. But I mean, that's why they picked the Lagrange points, because they wanted a stable position. Otherwise, the damn thing would just float away. So, unfortunately, there's no such thing as a pass for gravitational fields. If it's going to semi-secure its location, it's going to trap all kinds of little particles as well. It doesn't require a ticket. So, yeah, that's the negative aspect. But, you damned if you do, you damned if you don't. You had to kind of really place it in a somewhat stable orbit.
Yeah, I see. I guess the fact that, as you said, that they over-engineered it, so they've accounted for a certain amount of that degradation. Good.
Yeah, I mean, they're taking a look at it as a probability function, which means if you run a billion James Webb telescopes, probably it works out well. Problem is, probabilities kind of give you problems if you just have one sample. So we may be lucky. We may be unlucky. You never know. But I'm glad it's out there. And, again, I'm really looking forward to some beautiful images and some beautiful information. It's going to be able to peer closer to the edge of the observable universe than any other telescope that I'm aware of. There are others. There was, I think, a French space telescope that was designed more for the far infrared, which really is not optimal for that the far distances that the Webb is for. All interesting information, and there's all kinds of questions that still remains about the universe. And unfortunately, as I mentioned earlier, there's one big thing that I don't think we're ever going to be able to figure out, which is how big is the darn thing? Because there's only so far that we can perceive. So how far does it go past that point? And there are all kinds of interesting theories. Some of them are reasonable, and some of them are hysterically funny.
Yeah, like what's the name says, space is big, really big. You might think it's far to the corner drugstore, but that's nothing compared to space.
Yes, indeed. I don't know who said that. I mean, it sounds like it comes from Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah, the author of Hitchhiker's Guide. Can't think of his name now, but the author of Hitchhiker's Guide. I still don't panic.
That's very wise, and always carry a towel.
Hi.
Yes, indeed. By the way, you guys, if you never read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, unless you really hate reading or you hate science fiction or you hate a very funny science fiction, pick the darn thing up. It exists in an infinite number of forms. There are about, I think at last count, 6 volumes of the thing, the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and then further books that kind of go farther into it. It started weirdly as a BBC radio drama, which was very successful, which then became a BBC television show, which then became a movie, which was not funny, unfortunately. And along the way, the guy who wrote the original radio drama wrote all the books, and unfortunately, he passed away rather young. I think he was in his late 40s or early 50s when he passed away. But hysterically funny series of books. Go out there and read them.
According to Jim Freund on WBAI, his program Hour of the Wolf, yeah, it started as a radio drama, a BBC radio drama.
Yes. The first time I discovered it was the television show. And then I read the books, and then I got a copy of the BBC radio drama, which was funny as hell. And, the last thing I saw, fortunately, was the movie, because if I had seen the movie earlier, it would probably have stopped me from all the other things, because, you know, you got to save good stories from Hollywood. They're almost guaranteed to kill them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. The movie was really terrible, but the original radio drama was very good. Speaking of science fiction, if you don't mind, I just today, last day or two, have been rereading some of my other science fiction. I was rereading Larry Niven's Not Long Before the End. It's a sword and sorcery science fiction, but where he treats the force behind magic as a usable resource, and it's a fight that occurs between a warlock and a swordsman, but the warlock knows that magic is a force that can be used up. So it's an interesting, cute story. So he has this little wheel, which he puts a spell on it to spin it, with no upper limit, and it uses up all of the mana, all of the magic force in that area, and that's how he defeats the swordsman.
God, that sounds interesting. I have to see, I have to take a look for that book. Maybe I can find an audio version. Sometimes I play audio books before I go to sleep. I have a computer program that has a kill switch, so every 10 minutes, if I don't hit the button, it just stops, and I just start snoring and sleeping. So I got to look into that. As long as we touched upon science fiction books, I'm presently reading a series which has gained a lot of fame A lot of people talk it up, and if you can kind of tunnel through the first 50 or 100 pages, it does get better. It's called the three-body problem. So if anyone talks to you about the three-body problem, it's written by a Chinese author. The early pages is a lot of communist China, which kind of annoyed the heck out of me. But I'm finally coming out of that tunnel into a proper science fiction story where there are a civilization on a star system that has three stars that was looking for a place to call home. And when they got our signal, they decided that they were coming and they were going to kill us all and take over the Earth. So it's an interesting book. It's a series of three books, and it's called Three Body Problem.
Yes, I think I've heard of it. As a matter of fact, I listened to a science fiction program on WBAI. It's called Hour of the Wolf. It comes on at 9 p.m. on Monday on 99.5 with a guy named Jim Freund. I think he has reviewed that. I think he mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, the three-body problem. Yeah, but this story by Larry Niven, if you look it up, it's called Not Long Before the End. It's a cute little story. So back to you.
Okay, I mean, is it a novel? Is it a novella? Or is it just a very short story?
Originally, it was a short story called Not Long Before the End. However, it generated so much interest that several people have written in that universe. He came out with a follow-up story called The Magic Goes Away, and then there's even a follow-up to that, The Magic May Return, where several people have written in that universe, in that genre of magic being a usable resource that can be used up and can be restored.
Oh, okay. Like I said, I'll have to take a look, and especially if I can find an audio book version of it, that would make my life a lot easier. Usually, when I was growing up, I really tended to like hard science fiction. I really loved Asimov. Ray Bradbury to a degree, Heinlein, loved Heinlein. Heinlein was a crazy man, was a raving lunatic, but and a libertarian and all kinds of weird things. And a friend of L. Ron Hubbard. So he had a lot of weird things going on in his life, but I loved to read his books and such. So I was really into hard science fiction, although one of my favorite is Lord of the Rings. I think J.R.R. Tolkien is kind of not the same as most of the sword and sorcerer authors out there. You know, I read Sword of Shannara, which was from an author who made a lot of money making a lot of books that I didn't read because I didn't like that book. So I'll take it a look. I love science fiction, to this day. I tend to like... Cyberpunk was interesting in its day. It was kind of anti-Japanese generally and had some kind of weird racist kind of rant to it all, but cyberpunk had its interesting aspects, but there was nothing like an Isaac Asimov book. He was a real smart guy. He had a PhD in biochemistry. He taught in medical school, and he wrote more books than I've read. It's a shame he died of HIV contracted from a blood transfusion. That's a shame, too.
Yeah, I used to read a lot of Asimov along with some Le Guin. When you talk about the humorous science fiction stories before, I remember there was an older collection of short stories by Clark called Tales from the White Hart. This was a pub in England, the White Hart, and there's a number of stories that go on that take place there with discussions between various people there. It was an older publication from Clark, Arthur Clark.
Okay, very good. I'm writing all these things down. I keep notes on my technical net, so I'll have to take a look at that as well. I think I've mentioned before, there's a relatively new author. He hasn't really written that many books. I think he originally was a computer programmer type of a guy, but he picked up his word processor. And he's done a series called The Babaverse. The idea is that the main character sells his dot-com business to someone for millions of dollars and springs for a cryogenic plan where the moment he's dead, they freeze his head and they say that they're going to bring him back when technology allows it. So about 3 days after he signs the contract, he gets involved in a car accident and dies, and the world changes in terrible ways. And when he wakes up, he finds out that his body and his brain were disposed of, but they used his memory patterns to program an artificial intelligence to run a spaceship arc to get the heck out of Earth and go elsewhere and start a new civilization. And it's just a terribly funny series of books. It started as a single book and was successful, became a trilogy, and I think the publishers have talked them into writing three more episodes for the book. So I don't remember his name, but if you Google Babaverse, it'll come up.
The plot sounds very familiar. Yeah, I think I've heard that mentioned somewhere before. It does sound familiar. I'll have to check on that. What was the name of it again? The Babaverse?
Yeah. The guy's first name was Bob, and so his personality got inserted into an artificial intelligence, and he's been producing other ARC ships and cloning his artificial intelligence to theirs. So every one of hundreds and hundreds of different Bobs out there. So they when they get turned on, they have to choose a name that isn't Bob. But you know, in their own mind, it's a universe of Bobs. So they call it the Bobaverse.
Okay, I'll have to look for that. You know, I'm writing these down also, so I'll be looking for that also. Okay.
Yeah, he's very entertaining. He uses a lot of stuff he learned in IT, but a lot of physics. So there's kind of, despite the fact that there's a lot of humor, there's a lot of sort of hard science. He doesn't make up anything magical or mystical or such. And a lot of things are abstractions from theories that are ever-present in the literature of science, you know, nanotechnology, Dyson spheres, all those fun things he kind of uses to extend the story. So funny as hell and entertaining. And, you know, again, well written. A lot of people don't really write terribly well. They either go into too much, just kind of explaining things. You know, the old master said, don't explain it, do it. So, you know, very good book. So anyone out there who's interested in getting a good read that amuses you, I mean, it's not going to educate you terribly, but it'll entertain you a great deal.
Yeah, that seems to be a general rule in good sci-fi, or good writing in general, is don't explain too much. As you say, sort of show them, but don't explain too much in detail.
Yeah, for people who want to be authors out there, exposition is your enemy, even for movies, especially for movies. If you're making a movie, don't explain too much. Don't have crawls that go round and round and round. Don't have characters who point out what's happening at the same moment, because you think that the people watching your movie are just kind of staring at their popcorn and not paying attention to the movie. So exposition is your enemy.
I think that's what messed up Plan 9 from Outer Space, among other things.
Everything messed up Plan 9 from Outer Space. You silly, silly humans. I mean, where do you get dialogue like that?
Yeah, I saw that. I have that on tape, I think, someplace, and I played it the other day, and I couldn't believe it. It's amazing. It's so bad, but yet it's good in its badness. It reeks, but yet it's still good in its reekiness.
See, I kind of preferred the Ed Wood parody, the movie that was done about Ed Wood. It was certainly better done and to me much more entertaining. For a really cheap, a terrible movie, one that I particularly loved, I caught it on the Million Dollar Movie some Sunday afternoon when it was raining and I was a kid and had nothing better to do, was The Creation of the Humanoids. It was a terrible early 1950s, cheaply done science fiction movie about human beings becoming sterile, and they were making robots that looked more and more human. And it was the interactions and the troubles between the two groups.
I got to keep an eye on that. Maybe Sven Gulli will do it.
Yeah, it's got to be someplace. I mean, it took me a while to find a copy for myself, but Creation of the Humanoids. I mean, there were all kinds of things. I really loved Donovan's Brain. Really bad production values. Really kind of silly story if you really unfold it. But I don't know. I can still kind of play it in my mind as the 8-year-old that I was when I first saw it.
Yeah, I remember that one. I remember a couple of movies there from the 50s that don't get much play that really were not that bad. One of them I remember was Gog, G-O-G, like Gog and Magog. I have that on DVD, and it's when you look at it, it's really not that bad overall.
Okay, I missed that entirely. I mean, my two favorite good production science fiction movies from the 50s, and we used to talk about this back in Dick's time because he was a big fan, was Forbidden Planet. I loved Forbidden Planet. I mean, I mentioned before, and I'll mention it again, I have a couple of Robbie the Robot sitting around in my shack to attest to that. So it was that, and it was also the Day the Earth Stood Still. I just enjoyed, and I do have Klaatu someplace in the shack as well, so I have both of them. But those, if you asked me my favorite science fiction movies of the 50s, those would be my top two.
Yes, unquestionably, I thoroughly agree. Forbidden Planet and the original Day the Earth Stood Still with Michael Remy, they are really, I think, the best of that whole 50s genre. Every time Forbidden Planet runs on TCM, I always have to watch it.
Yes, Rich?
Invasion from Mars. One of the greatest ever. Little-known film, Invasion from Mars. It scared me to death when I was 7 years old, and I'm still scared to death.
Okay, you know they had a I think it was a bubblegum card collection with that premise, and the same guy who made Ed Woods kind of made one for the, I think it was in the 1980s, Mars Attacks.
Yeah, this is a film where the invaders would stick a dart in your neck and then you would become like them. And I remember this kid's parents got shot with the darts. I mean, it was, it's amazing. It's like no other film I've ever seen in my life. Invasion from Mars. I don't know who did it, or I don't know much about it, but I know it's sort of a cult-type film. Anyway, back to you, Ned.
Is that the one where the kid sees the ship landing in his backyard, and then the whole thing turns into be a dream, and then it actually happens.
Sid, you got it.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yes, at the time I first saw that, I did find that somewhat scary, yeah. That thing that they put in his neck, and when they didn't want to use anybody anymore, they exploded it, and it would cause the person to you know, have like a stroke or something. Yeah, I remember that.
AC2GS. Well, if I had to pick a third favorite 1950 science fiction, I guess, grudgingly, it would be Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Now, talk about a movie that's been redone. I've lost count. I think there must be four Invasion of the Body Snatchers over the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, I think there have been quite a few remakes of that. There's another picture that part of it is good, and then it degenerates. The movie is This Island Earth. There's a scene in there, it's the first part, where he's working in this laboratory where he has to build this interocitor or something, but it shows him doing a voltage breakdown test on these capacitors. It actually looks fairly realistic, but then it deteriorates from there. But the first part of it where it shows his laboratory work is kind of interesting. It was This Island Earth.
Okay, I'll have to take a look at that as well. You know, with Hollywood, it's just as likely that they kind of ran out of budget very quickly.
I guess we need a sci-fi net.
We sort of had one a long time ago on One Astronomy Net. I think Craig was in the mood to talk about science fiction movies, and so for the hour that the Astronomy Net was on, it was a discussion of his favorite science fiction and others. Science fiction kind of feeds science. It's in some degrees... It generates self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, almost everyone and their brother has mentioned that the communicators of the Star Trek Enterprise look like a lot like flip phones that Motorola designed, in the 90s, the StarTAC and such. And I don't think that was accidental. There's a lot of that goes on. So, I mean, I think a lot of young pre-scientists get the science bug more from science fiction than from science fact.
Yeah, I think you have a point there. I know I remember that program. What was it? It was Science Fiction Theater with Truman Bradley. He would always start the program with a demonstration of something that was usually hard science, and then he would show this little half-hour science fiction skit. But, again, a lot of his beginning demonstrations were often right out of Mr. Wizard, I guess you could say. They were usually hard science. And it was a nice presentation. I think I have the whole series on DVD.
Oh, yeah, geez, that would be nice to have. Yeah, I mean, I saw some of them. Obviously, I didn't see all of them. But again... For whatever reason, it was just much more accessible to me to pull these books, these science fiction books, out of the library. And a lot of them showed up in the juvenile section that I started using when I was very young, before I graduated to my neighborhood's library's basement, where all the nonfiction stuff was kept. So, you know, over the next 5-6 years, I think I took out their entire basement.
Yeah, there is a certain attitude there where, for some reason, science fiction is not considered serious. In my opinion, some of the writings that are done are really serious literature that really, deserve the respect as good literature, but again, in some cases, it's not taken serious. I remember I was reading, I guess, another one by Larry Niven, the whole Ring World series, very well done, where it's sort of a midway between a ring and a Dyson sphere. It's a nice series of books. It starts with Ring World and Ring World Engineers. I think it's up to a tetralogy now, if I'm not mistaken. But there's a lot of good SF literature out there, as well as the stuff by Ursula K. Le Guin. I usually watch every time a PBS shows, The Lathe of Heaven, that she wrote, which is a nice story. Very well done.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem was that science fiction began as pulp fiction. You know, in the, I guess, the 1930s and on, they used the cheapest paper and these little pulpy, disposable, soft cover books and magazines, and it was inexpensive, so it was kind of designed for kids and people who didn't have that much money. And you know, it wasn't kind of framed in a high-class sort of way, so it tended to have derision back then. But, you know, over the years, I mean, Hollywood has made billions and billions of dollars off of science fiction, so I think it's less of a problem. You know, you had guys like Philip K. Dick. It's sort of a shame. He didn't really generate any real money until he died. That was when Blade Runner came out. He probably passed away just around that time. He had a problem with amphetamines. And, you know, up until then, he was cranking out a ridiculous number of words per day, probably with the thanks of the amphetamines. You know, they didn't get paid well. They got paid pennies on the word or page or whatever, and they just survived one day at a time. You know, back in the old days, L. Ron Hubbard was a science fiction writer, and he joked that that was no way to make money. If you want to really make money, start your own religion.
Yeah, that's what he did.
Yep, that's what he did. And he was friends, as I mentioned before, with Heinlein, Robert H. Heinlein. And I think Heinlein as kind of a joke or something. I think part of what drew him to write Stranger in a Strange Land was that he was going to show L. Ron Hubbard that he could make a religion too.
Never heard that one.
Yeah, Stranger in a Strange Land is completely filled with religious aspects to it. You know, the Chosen One returns from Mars with the powers of the long dead Martians, and he starts his own little religion with the help of other people. And again, Robert Heinlein was a very weird writer. I mean, there were family relationships that were so ridiculously temporally incestuous, I lost track. At one point, one of his main characters was his own father. So, I don't know. Interesting guy, probably a great guy to have a conversation with, probably a terrible guy to run a country because he was a libertarian towards the end. But nevertheless, fascinating guy. You know, if you never read a Heinlein book, read a couple of them. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, perhaps.
Yeah, I have a couple of Heinlein books upstairs, and I haven't read them yet. Maybe I'll crack one open before the summer ends.
There's loads of good stuff. I mean, actually, he ran a series in the 50s, juvenile books for meant for teenager type of people, and more than a few of them actually placed one of the characters as an amateur radio operator.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you know which one that was?
I am not 100% sure. Could be R for rocket or something like that. Again, he kind of spewed a lot of those things in the 50s. He was kind of ambivalent. You know, they gave him a living, but they didn't really make him feel terribly proud of himself. But if you go through the synopsises of Hyland's juvenile books, there was one book where some brilliant genius and a group of kids get together and build a rocket and go to the moon. And one of the kids was an amateur radio operator. So he was the guy who worked on the electronics part. And I think there were others where amateur radio was kind of mentioned off to the side. But, I mean, that struck me because it's very, very rare, even in the 50s, to have hams as characters in books.
Was one of Hyland's stories turned into that movie, Destination Moon? I remember that from the 50s.
I am not familiar. The only Hyland book that I can recall that was made into a movie was the one, and I don't remember exactly, Star Troopers. It was kind of turned into a fascist parody where the Earth was fighting insects and they were running commercials to join the armed forces and be a man type of thing. And it was done very much satirically, tongue-in-cheek, but a lot of people who reviewed the movie failed to understand what the movie was actually about. You know, it was the same guy who did RoboCop.
Star Troopers. I think I've seen that. I think that's made the rounds on the cable channels. I think I have seen that.
Yeah, that started as one of his juvenile series where, you know, they were just, it didn't have the sarcasm of the movie. It didn't quite have the totally fascistic elements to it. But it was, the basic premise was a military force made up of basically high school graduates go off and kill a bunch of insect enemies.
That sounds interesting. I've heard it said, maybe this is an explanation for it, that the elements of science fiction really are being used in more and more stories now, like that series that was on Starz, Outlander, where it used the elements of time travel. And, of course, there was a couple of other ones, Time Traveler's Wife and a couple of other ones, but a lot of the elements of science fiction now are being used in many stories because it seems to be the only way that they have the variety of the various different modes of presenting a story, and that it seems to be the most vibrant, so I've heard.
Yeah, it kind of extends your selection. You know, there's more than a few drama books that say that there's only 9 stories in the world, and everything we read or see is just variations of those 9. Some people say it's 7, some people say it's 4, and ultimately there are some smart asses out there who just say it's 1, it's the hero's journey type of thing. But yeah, if you extend, you can extend it with science fiction, and of course, as I mentioned before, you know, back in the 50s, back in the 30s, science fiction was just cheap pulp stuff that people just wrote reams of that were not valued at all. 50, they were low production value, kind of silly drive-in films. When we got into the 60s and the 70s, we got 2001 A Space Odyssey, and then we got Star Trek, and people started to take science fiction a lot more seriously. And then, you know, with Star Wars and with the comic book heroes, it's a billion-dollar industry. So everyone wants to go into a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah, I know. It seems that every year, every summer, they come out with a hope what will be the new blockbuster, trying to recapture that Star Wars fluff from years ago when it first came out.
AC2GS. Yeah, I mean, if you get away with it, it's a printing press. DC Warner Brothers has a great intellectual property. I think Batman and Superman and such are worth billions of dollars if you do it right. Problem is, they don't really do it terribly right. They spend a lot of money, I guess, on special effects, not much on the director, not much on the writer, and it kind of shows. There's only so much CGI you can tolerate. CGI, in my humble opinion, is something like a spice. It kind of adds a little bit extra to the taste, but you don't want a plate of peppers or anything like that. So they overpower it with a lot of CGI, and you just get numb to the noise.
Yeah, a lot of things seem to be done because they can be done. In other words, the latest CGI effect, I'll see what we can do, so let's find some place to put it.
Yeah, also, though, it's easier to sell. You don't have to explain any difficult concepts to anyone. I mean, there's a lot of guys out there who want to keep it very simple. So the best way to keep plot points very simple and to keep people entertained is to keep blowing things up on the screen. And so they blow stuff up. It goes back to that great joke from the 1980s. Blows it all up.
Well, sounds good to me. Anyway, I really enjoyed this little conversation, Roy. So I'm going to be heading up. I got to go out early tomorrow to do a food shopping. We always food shop very early in the morning, so there's no crowds. So I really appreciate the conversation, and I hope Paul is feeling okay. If he's listening, anything, I wish him get well soon, get healthy soon.
Yes, indeed. I hope he gets well very, very, very soon. And I thank you, John, for having this conversation with me. I enjoy it. There's lots of things that I, given the half the opportunity, and Rich, W2BZ, knows full well, given half the opportunity, I enjoy discoursing about. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity to chatting with you and talking about something that I truly love, which is science fiction and books in general. I have way more books than I should have. I need a bigger house to hold all these darn books. So thank you, John. Anyway, this is AC2GS, so before we call it a night, anyone with any closing comments would like to make? Okie doke. I guess everyone's either talked out or listened out or what have you. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Thanks especially to Andy for Andy's Corner. And as always, thank you, Paul, for all that you do. I'm sorry to hear that you're not well, but I'm sure you'll get well very, very soon. And I hope that next Sunday we'll have a great new SpaceNet report. I want to remind everyone, if you want to reach me via email, you can do it. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page for a bunch of interesting articles that I've read and YouTubes that I've seen. There's a Veritasium YouTube that's very fascinating. I really think most people should see it. It's very informative. You type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com and you can get to my link page. And, of course, there's the audio stream at technet.ac2gs.com. And, as always, my KC2NJR's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv. He has over 1 million visitors, so make it 1,000,001. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I gave the repeater a chance to advertise itself. As always, Dick used to leave the technical net with advice to please be kind to each other, and that's always good advice. It's particularly good advice these days with all the things buzzing about our heads. So stay safe, be well, and please join me again next Sunday night when we try and do it all over again. And as my running repeat of a quote from a Greek philosopher, Epictetus, it's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep that in mind. Sometimes we think we know, but we don't know. So always check to make sure that you know what you think you know. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and have a great week. Be well. We'll talk again down the line. So I formally close this episode of the Limark Technical Net, and I